Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 214 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. As always, don't forget, the Dudes and Beer podcast is brought to you by Amazon Audible. If you're a fan of audiobooks, if you're a fan of reading and just don't have time to turn a leaf anymore, feel free to download Amazon Audible. You can get it at audibletrials.com/dudesandbeer. That will get you 30 free days and 2 free book downloads. So go on by, check them out, help support the cause. audibletrials.com/dudesandbeer. Tonight, I am joined not only by my great brother, Randy. Randy, welcome back to the show.
No, thank you.
You've been on numerous times, and I can't wait for you to chime in this evening with one of our returning and regular guests, Dr. John Hall, who is joining us live from San Antonio. How are you today, Dr. Hall?
Doing good, Chris. How are you guys?
Doing fantastic,
doing
my
well.
Friend. We will be discussing tonight the apparent raging opioid epidemic in the United States. And I say epidemic as opposed to crisis because we are at epidemic levels, folks. We have gotten to the point where the deaths, both suicidal and just medicinal overdose-wise, have reached the level with the CDC that are of epidemic proportions, into the thousands a year. And that's why we had Dr. Hall on tonight to talk about this. He actually approached me and was like, Chris, we have to cover this. And it's very interesting that tonight, the night that we do decide to truly cover this topic in depth, is the same night that it was announced that the CEO and the another officer, as well as the chief compliance officer of one of the major, one of the top 10 drug distributors in America, has been charged with defrauding the federal government, with defrauding the DEA. Their compliance officer has already pled guilty. We will see what shakes out of the tree as far as the CEO and other executives that have been charged in that case. But just to know that that landmark decision has already come out, that they are, that at least one person has pled guilty to the fact that he helped distribute narcotics on a mass scale. We're talking into the hundreds of thousands of prescriptions that were illegal, that he just did not turn over illegal sale documents to the DEA. Dr. John Hall, with your experience as an anesthesiologist and in the pain realm especially, that is a lot of your clientele. How has this situation come to bear on the medical industry over the last many years, and what are we looking at right now?
Well, I'll tell you, for your listeners that probably have mostly heard me talking about electronic harassment and stalking and, you know, things like that, I've got books out on that. But my real gig is I do pain management, anesthesiologist, board-certified anesthesia, and worked with one of the second largest spine surgery groups in the state of Texas, doing stem cells, doing PRP, and doing chronic pain management. And while we are at epidemic proportions of opioid use in this country, as a matter of fact, even as long as 10 years ago, about 95% of the hydrocodone produced on the global market was being used in America. Pain treatment is kind of an unusual thing in the United States, that it has been traditionally treated with narcotic medications. You go to Mexico or Europe, even after surgery in Europe, you get a very potent form of Tylenol called acetamol that's actually used for pain there. And you can't get narcotics in the pharmacies in Mexico at all. As a matter of fact, I have a friend that runs a plastic surgery clinic down there, and they do give you sedation. They use a lot of local anesthetics in the tube to kind of prevent pain for a while, and then they use either ibuprofen or Tylenol or a combination of the two. So a lot of the people from Mexico will come across the border into the States to get hydrocodone or Percocet or wow. OxyContin, you know, while, you know, you have the people from the United States crossing the border the other direction to, you know, get diet pills and things that are available there. But even while we do have an epidemic of opioid use here, the people that have really kind of been hurt the most by it are truly the chronic pain patients.
Well, and most of that, it really surprises me, the statistic you're talking about, because I remember back in the day, people used to go across the border all the time for medications. You didn't need a prescription. You could just go to the pharmacy and, hey, yeah, you know, whatever you needed. But it is definitely not like 1985 anymore. It's not the 80s like it used to be. And like we were saying before the show, a lot of this stuff is specifically things like OxyContin. A lot of the heavier opioids became highly regulated back in the 90s when we started taking ephedrine off the shelves because people were making homemade crystal methamphetamine with it. It came around the same, which was the same time that cough medications started going to pseudoephedrine instead of ephedrine in their formula, and it was right up around the same time that we had the ketamine abuse going on in the country. But like we said before the show, it's interesting. Go ahead.
And that's when they started making you get your allergy medicine behind the counter at the pharmacy, mm-hmm. and having to show an ID. And, you know, you couldn't go in and order a case of Sudafed tablets anymore to cook meth with. You know, even Sudafed now, you have to get it behind the counter. But, and a lot of this, kind of where we're at now, started about 6 years ago now, when they rescheduled hydrocodone. Because you're right, they had already scheduled the OxyContins and the morphines and the methadones, where that pretty much had to be written by a pain management doctor or an addiction specialist. But hydrocodone was still a pain medication that the family doctors could prescribe, and, you know, didn't, if you needed that, didn't necessarily mean that you had to be sent to a pain management physician. Yeah. Well, about 5 years ago, they rescheduled that to where if you went into your pain doctor and you had sprained your ankle or broke something and had a cast on and needed to be on a week or two of a pain medication, well, now that person has to be sent to pain management as well to get that. So it really has kind of swamped our offices, you know, with maybe some of the more minor pains and things that we typically didn't see before, you know, knee pain and ankle pain and, you know, people waiting for surgery on their knee or arthritis. Because even the rheumatologist, now the arthritis doctors, even though they treat a painful condition, are scared to write narcotics. So now they'll go there to get their arthritic meds, but they'll still get a referral to a pain management center to get anything that's narcotic for pain.
Well, and granted, I mean, I'm not one that's opposed to regulation. Don't get me wrong, folks. I mean, the proper regulations in the proper places make things work smoothly and go right. But when we're talking about pain management, when we're talking about these things, like we aren't necessarily talking about people that are addicts looking for a way to feed their fix. We're talking about people like, for instance, my mother, medically retired from teaching because of her pain management issues, because of raging back pain. The fact that she has to walk with a walker now just made her a literal moving road hazard in the hallways of the school she works at. So you're talking about people like that. We're talking about our grandparents, our parents, who are dealing with this. It's not your college age kids, like the ketamine issue was, or even necessarily the drug cartels, like things like the amphetamines, and making methamphetamines out of readily available pills off the shelf. It's not necessarily in that realm. Like we were saying before the show, you aren't necessarily going to see a drug dealer to pick up some hydrocodone.
Well, and for your listeners, coming from a pain management standpoint, I mean, before we get too much further along, I just kind of would like to basically explain that from a medical standpoint, we really kind of see pain in three ways. There's acute pain, meaning that you've, you know, ran into your truck hitch and you've broke your shin and you've got acute pain that's going to heal, but you may need something for, you know, 5 to 7 days while it heals. That category would also be the person who goes in and has their appendix out, has their gallbladder out, you know, has a minor injury where you do need a, you know, 7 to 14 day script for usually hydrocodone or Percocet or, you know, one of the lower level pain medications for a temporary amount of time until you start to heal. Well, then you enter into chronic pain. Chronic pain has two types. There's chronic non-cancer pain and chronic cancer pain. And believe it or not, they are treated somewhat differently. I mean, anybody that's, you know, been pronounced with cancer that's inoperable, where they're basically living out their last days with cancer, we still pretty much have an open window to treat that. I mean, that's one of those things where you try to make those people as comfortable as you can. Mm-hmm. And there's usually not a lot of restrictions as long as you chart on those people and it's well indicated that that they have a fatal cancer. And I have a number of patients that fit that criteria. The kind of the sticker with the DEA, with the medical boards in each state, and with pain management, and certainly with family medicine, which has pretty much been wiped out of completely prescribing pain medications, is chronic non-cancer pain. And that would be things like severe knee arthritis, severe arthritis of the shoulders, people that have had back surgery. And, I mean, my practice has been with one of the larger spine groups. I've got patients in there from surgeons that have done, I've got one lady that's had 17 back surgeries from the same surgeon. And anybody that's ever known anybody or gone through back surgery themselves knows that each surgery tends to have less and less success.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't get fixed with the initial back surgery, typically what happens is those patients still have pain rating down their legs.
Yeah.
They find another surgeon. That surgeon says, well, I can go back in and remove the hardware and I can fix you. They do a surgery. They add more hardware. Patient still hurts. And they kind of keep on looking for surgeons to fix them. And, you know, and of course, each surgery usually makes you worse until finally somebody says, well, you know, that's all we can do. We've fused your entire spine. We need to send you to pain management. And there are techniques that we use in pain management to alleviate pain other than narcotics. Unfortunately, most of those techniques involve steroids.
Yeah.
And steroids and radiofrequency ablation can get rid of some of the back pain. Won't get rid of leg pain too well, but people that have back pain from the joints in the spine getting arthritic, whether on their own from arthritis or from surgery, we can usually do blocks on those. If the pain goes away, we can go back in and radiofrequency ablate those nerves that cause the pain. But that only works partially, and people with stenosis, which is another spine disorder where you just have arthritis building up and pinching the nerve roots, will cause nerve pain shooting down your legs and back pain. And those are the people that typically, in your neck or back, end up on chronic pain management with chronic opioid use. And in the past, it was kind of like basically pain was, as we were taught, pain is the, you know, the fourth vital sign, the third vital sign, and make sure that you actually treat pain. And one of the things that, you know, we were taught was that you basically start low and dose upward until you get relief, and that's kind of the level you start at. And a lot of chronic pain patients would be placed on a long-acting drug that they took one in the morning and one at night, and then maybe two or three short-acting doses of a drug, single drug, that they would take for breakthrough pain during the day. And for most people, that system worked pretty well. Well, now that they're restructuring the guidelines and the CDC has come out with new guidelines, which they do make sense. The CDC's new guidelines say that for acute pain, you should start with something that's non-narcotic, like a combination of ibuprofen and acetaminophen. And then in a stepwise process, go upward into narcotics as you need to. So that stepwise process would mean using combination of ibuprofen and acetaminophen. If that doesn't work, possibly tramadol. Tramadol doesn't work, get into lower level narcotics like Tylenol with codeine, then hydro, then Percocet, and reserve the more potent narcotics for chronic pain. But the problem is that they established a cutoff that's called a morphine milligram equivalency. in MMEs, or morphine milligram equivalency, is determined by whatever combination of narcotics you're on, what is its equivalent in milligrams of morphine. And I sent you a link, I don't know if you posted it, on how a patient can actually calculate their MMEs. Because the new guidelines are, for family doctors, no more than 40 morphine equivalents. To give you an idea, that would be 4 hydrocodone a day. For chronic pain, you can work your way up to 90 morphine equivalents. Well, you can't be on 9 hydrocodone a day because that's a fatal dose of Tylenol.
Yeah.
So to get up to 90, you would use a combination of a long-acting drug and a short-acting drug for breakthrough pain. But even at 90 morphine equivalents, for somebody that's had multiple back surgeries, they may have been on 200 morphine equivalents for the last 10 years, and were doing fine with that, and, you know, achieving their daily living activities. Well, now they're being told, well, to keep you in the pain clinic, we have to have you at 90 or below. Some pain clinics, or even like my former pain clinic, is saying 40 or below. They're actually holding these chronic pain patients to family practice standards, not chronic pain management standards. So now we have people that have been functioning on these doses for years coming in and saying, well, we either got to cut you down to 90 or 40 morphine equivalents, or let you go from the practice altogether. And there's really not a lot of places for these people to go, because a lot of these pain clinics, if you're a medical treat only, meaning that everything's been tried, including stimulators and radiofrequency ablation, and all that's left for you is opioid therapy, well, that's not a procedural patient. That's not someone that a pain group can do procedures on, bill insurance on. So to some extent, you know, like everything in medicine, it's financially driven.
Yeah.
So a lot of these patients are finding themselves with no place to go, no place to turn to.
Yeah, and like we were saying, I mean, most of these patients don't have access to their neighborhood drug dealer. They don't. The people that you're hearing about, folks that are turning to heroin, that are turning to fentanyl patches, things like that, are people that typically already had an addiction issue before they got into pain management, or had the means by which to get illicit drugs before they got into pain management. Like we were saying before the show, people like my mom. She ain't going to go out and find heroin on the street. You aren't just going to go out and find heroin on the street. You got to kind of know somebody to know what street to go to get the heroin. That's how
I didn't know
about the back alley behind Kroger till I watched the after school special.
Well, and I always cringe when I see the media has really kind of touted that, because on one hand they say, oh, there's an opioid crisis in this country and people are ODing and we got to do something. And then the next episode, they'll say, but these chronic pain patients are being forced to turn to heroin. And honestly, in 22 years of practice in pain management, I maybe have seen one or two people that come in and admit to me that, or test positive for heroin. They go, well, when I got cut off on my pain medications from my other pain management doctor, you know, and had to get heroin, you know, to as a standby. Well, those were people with prior addictive problems and had been on heroin before, and probably got kicked out of their original pain management office for testing positive for heroin along with their prescription meds. we do, one of the safeguards that most, if anyone out there is listening that's thinking about going into pain management or already is in pain management, one of the things that they started pushing us to do a long time ago was point of care drug testing, which means that in order to get your script, you got to pee, and that really isn't to find illicit drugs so much as it is to verify that you're taking the drugs that we're prescribing you.
Yes.
Because if you're getting a prescription for Percocet every month or hydrocodone every month for chronic pain, we expect to see that drug in your system. And if you're filling that script every month and you come in and it's not in your urine, then that kind of points us to the fact that you may be diverting your drugs. So that's one of the reasons that
difference between the accumulated amount in your system as opposed to like, oh, hey, I got to pee tomorrow, I should take a pill. That's very evident whenever you start doing the spectrography on human now with hair, the with the things like that.
Now with the new CDC guidelines, though, in the past we weren't really too concerned with illicit drugs. I mean, obviously if you came in and you tested positive for cocaine every single time, I mean, we would talk to you, we would counsel you, give you a chance to come in clean, to maintain on your prescription drugs before we would get rid of you. Well, now there's even more of a push to not only identify the drug that's being prescribed in the urine, but to watch for any illicit drugs, because now the CDC has said, well, there's a component of, you know, admixing, you know, street drugs with prescription drugs that may be leading to death more than if somebody's just on their hydrocodone alone. So now, pretty much, if you come into a pain management office and you test positive for apomorphine, which is the tag that tells us that you're on heroin, it's the congener of heroin, or if you test positive for cocaine or methamphetamine, more than likely you're going to be asked to leave the pain clinic, because it's too risky for us if something happens to you. They're not going to blame it on the meth or the heroin. They're going to blame it on the prescription drug. So, I mean, that's just kind of the way things have gone, and that's the way the media has driven it.
Well, and insurance-wise, they would definitely look at the prescriber at that point. I myself even recently had some pretty major oral work done right after the episode where I was in San Antonio, actually. And the doctor told me, like, I understand you live in Austin. You're not going to be here all the time in Katy to see me. So here's a couple of prescriptions. Just don't fill that other one until it says to fill it. Don't try to bring it to them, anything like that. So
yeah,
even dentists are under the scrutiny now. It's gone all the way down the line. Like I was saying before the show, I myself have Seton Healthcare as my practitioner. I'm on anxiety meds, and I had a supplemental for a long time for whenever I traveled or had what was known to be a crazy stressful day. And it was a very small amount, 0.5 milligrams of clonazepam for extreme panic, things like that. Just really something to take the edge off. But they called me about 6 months ago. I have not had that for that period. They said that they would no longer, and it wasn't even at that point, it had gotten to the point where, like you said, I had to come in, regularly give them a urine sample every few months, so that they could see the fact that that was in my system, and that stuff. But now it's gotten to the fact that they are not even allowed to prescribe it anymore, at least for that use. Were it for pain management, yes. But for that use, they were like, if you have to use it for that, you have to now go see a psychiatrist in order to be prescribed clonazepam for that use.
And that is one of the things that we noticed a couple of years ago that started changing. And the new CDC guidelines actually do basically say to not prescribe narcotics and benzodiazepines at the same time, which benzodiazepines would be your Valium, Xanax, clonazepam, Ativan, those type of, you know, semi-sedative or anti-anxiolytic drugs for anxiety. And I can see why, and that's because if somebody overdoses on both of those, the respiratory suppressant you get from combining benzodiazepines with narcotics is synergistic. So the chances of you, if you overtake your narcotic and overtake your benzo on the same night, that it increases your chances of going to bed and never waking up. But however, on the other hand, people with chronic pain, there's a strong depression, anxiety, and pain circle where all of those kind of feed on each other. As the more you hurt, the more anxious you get, the more depressed you get. So in the past, it wasn't uncommon for us to use a combination of a little bit of narcotic, a little bit of an anti-anxiolytic, and a little bit of an antidepressant, Cymbalta, for instance, is one of the antidepressants that specifically is used for pain. And when you used a little bit of all three instead of a lot of one, then you usually would get pretty good results. Some of the other drugs that we use in pain management are Lyrica and Gabapentin, and both of those are now being, they claim, are being abused on the street. So we're being told to actually kind of limit, you know, our scope of using those, And gabapentin specifically, the trade name is Neurontin, was kind of a big standby for the family doctors once they were scared to write for hydrocodone. I mean, it didn't matter if you were having nerve pain or not. If you walked in and said, oh, well, I broke my arm and I've got pain, well, gabapentin, you know, they would put you in. It probably wasn't actually doing anything for that type of pain, but that was the best they had to offer. But so now, even in pain management clinics, if you need something for anxiety, if your pain is so bad that you're getting depressed and having anxiety, we can no longer prescribe that with narcotics. We have to also refer you, like Seton did with you, to a psychiatrist. And of course, then the psychiatrist now is, he sees that you're on, you know, maybe some narcotics for chronic pain, and he's going to be a little bit apprehensive about writing for those. So really, why these guidelines are well meant and probably needed to some extent, they're also scaring doctors out of actually prescribing these meds to patients that need them. And I've seen that happen at my former office. I'm in a new office currently, and some of my former colleagues are definitely afraid to write for narcotics. That's all you hear every day. Well, I know you've been on 6 hydrocodone a day. We're going to have to cut you down to 3. I don't want to lose my license. And, you know, it's sad that we've come to that, because a lot of these patients, you know, even if you go in front of the board, you know, when they peruse the charts, they're going to see this patient's had 3 or 4 back surgeries. They've had RF. They've had a trial stimulator, which is a device we use to short circuit the nerves coming out of the spine, causing pain. If it worked, they got a permanent stimulator. If it didn't work, they went back on chronic opioids. But a lot of times the proof is there in the chart that these people function better on their opioids. But nonetheless, you know, with being faced with, well, do you do what's right for the patient or you do what's right to protect your livelihood, then you've just about got to find some middle ground with patients. And the one good thing is we are finding that some of the people who were on really high doses of medications, once you wean them down slowly and get them down to something that's maybe at least close to 90 morphine equivalents, most of them find that they do okay. Now, the problem is where you have the patient that's been, maybe had 2 recent surgeries, has been on, you know, 6 or 7 Percocet a day for pain, and now you're having to tell them they've got to go off of Percocet and onto 3 hydrocodone a day. That's a pretty big jump down in potency. And those are the ones that are having problems, either because the doctors won't take time to wean them down slowly. And there are a couple of ways to do that. You can actually wean the medication itself down slowly, or you can stop it altogether, put the patient on Suboxone, which is a narcotic that not only relieves pain but stops withdrawal. But it's easier to wean off of Suboxone, get your receptors kind of back to normal, and then start over at lower doses of narcotics without escalating them. And that's kind of where the key is, and that's kind of the double-edged sword with narcotics as well, is getting those people to take those meds where it's kind of as a just needed when you're really hurting bad, so you never do get the tolerance to the medications that require your doctor to stepwise keep on raising the dose.
Yeah.
And the patients that we have now are the ones that over the last decade, you know, 2 hydrocodone may have did it 10 years ago. Well, then it's 4. Well, then it's 6. Well, then it's a combination of a long-acting drug and a short-acting drug. And then maybe pretty large doses of those. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, they work, but they also have to be a lot of times constantly increased if you're using them on a daily basis. Now, where I disagree with the DEA and the board with chronic pain management is they've told us, well, you have other avenues that you can treat these patients with. You've got injections you can do. Well, you can't give somebody steroids every week. No. You know, we do use anti-inflammatory steroids and nerve blocks and joint blocks and facet blocks and things like that. But that's dangerous, too. You can't give somebody steroids every week to control their pain because you'll shut their adrenal glands down. So at some point in the chronic pain process, opioid therapy is really about all you have. And it's a matter of combining small doses of opioids with other adjuvant drugs, you know, drugs that help the opioid work a little bit better. And, you know, I was one of the first people to start using CBD oil. Mm-hmm. I did some of the initial studies on using CBD for fibromyalgia. Fibromyalgia is one of the worst diseases as far as getting those people addicted to medications. For one, there's really not much of a way to prove it. The test for fibromyalgia is using pressure points. if you're tired and you hurt at these 13 points with this amount of pressure, then it's fibromyalgia. And the treatment for that is typically exercise and Lyrica or an antidepressant, maybe some really low-dose narcotics. The problem is once you go down the narcotic road, that type of patient usually is one of the ones more at risk for escalating the dose. And those are some of the people that are having to be, you know, severely weaned down. So what we did is when CBD became available to us in Texas, we took about 70 patients and we weaned them off of the narcotics and we ran them on CBD more in capsules, and had about 65% success rate in converting a lot of those patients off of narcotic and onto CBD, which we do have some really good pharmaceutical grade, prescription grade sources of CBD now. So,
yeah, and if you're somebody looking for those options, if you're looking for somebody to check that stuff out, feel free to stop on by diamondcbd.com, shameless self-promotion, and use the code DUDES420 to get 30% off your entire cart. I myself am a user of CBD oil regularly, and I'm here to tell you it helps. It really does do a great job as far as curtailing some of my anxiety as well as helping with some of my regular joint and back pain that I experience.
CBD oil is a very potent anti-inflammatory. It won't tear your stomach up. It won't tear your kidneys up the way ibuprofen does. And I don't know about Diamond. I know some of the other sources, but they do have a nano preparation of it now in capsule form.
Oh, wow.
That increases its potency. A lot of my patients with arthritis, we use it in a balm or a salve that can be applied directly to. Now, if you've got fibromyalgia, you need it systemically, and that's going to be an oil under your tongue or a capsule that you can use. But yeah, we've had great success with that. I've seen on some of the media talking about that, oh, it's great. I've seen other media sources going, oh, it's a placebo. The key is to find a company that will get you good pharmaceutical grade CBD isolate. And that's not going to be $29 for 10 ounces online.
No.
It's just not going to be, because it costs more than that to actually prepare it. So,
yeah. And, Randy, I know you had something that you were wanting to say a second ago. Go ahead.
Well, I was, you know, we were talking about, Doctor, you were mentioning the, you know, the government ratcheting down the MME numbers and all this pressure on doctors and clinics and prescribers to not prescribe this stuff. The distributor that was in the news today, I was reading through the article earlier, and between 2012 and 2016, they had just this appalling amount of growth. It's just, you look at their numbers and it's like,
it's just a 45 degree incline.
I don't even think it's that, man. I've seen Army aircraft take off steeper than that. I mean, this is from like 4.7 million doses to 42 million just in the span of 4 years.
Wow.
Okay, that was Oxy. Their fentanyl numbers.
That's tenfold growth, folks.
Yeah. Went from 63,000 for fentanyl to 1.3 million just in the span of 4 years. Now, is this just one company. Is this something that is, I don't know, is this something that other distributors, do you have any idea, have experienced any kind of increase like this? I imagine it's numbers like this that are fueling all of this pressure for doctors not to prescribe this stuff or to dramatically reduce it.
Those distributors were, it looks like, well, first off, if you read the article, that was Rochester Pharmaceutical Co-op. Right. And their compliance officer, who was supposed to be reviewing these pharmacies and these buyers to make sure that, you know, they were within guidelines, were looking the other way and going ahead and selling these medications. And you're going to find that probably all of these distributors are going to have some element of that. Because a lot of the purchases were going to pharmacies that were outright selling these drugs. They weren't stockpiling them, waiting for legitimate prescriptions to come in. These were drugs that were going to, a lot of them were probably mom and pop pharmacies that were, you know, where somebody else was getting those medications to be sold on the street. What'll be interesting to see is how many of those shipments were going to government agencies. That will be really interesting to see. But, you know, a lot of the illicit fentanyl was coming out of those type of, you know, warehouses. And a lot of it's coming from China and Vietnam and Mexico as illicit fentanyl that's being added to heroin to make heroin more potent. And that's where you'll see every now and again, you'll have this rash of heroin overdoses where the heroin has been laced with fentanyl, which is a very potent narcotic. I mean, fentanyl is one of the drugs we use to put you to sleep and relieve pain during anesthesia for surgery. And to give you an idea, a normal size human male having, let's say, an appendectomy might get 2 cc's of that IV for, you know, an hour, 2 hour long surgery, you know, which 2 cc's would be 100 micrograms. Well, 100 micrograms is what's in the strongest patch they make. And a fentanyl patch is a patch you wear for 3 days and then change it again every third day, getting 100 mics an hour, you know, while you have that patch on. So, you know, and the fentanyl patches that they're talking about in that article that are being prescribed, most of us, even doing chronic pain, have stopped using fentanyl patch. I mean, I can tell you, you know, 20 years ago for cancer pain and some really severe non-cancer pain, we would maybe start with a 12-mic patch or a 25-mic patch on certain people that had failed on lower potency narcotics. Cancer, of course, we still would use fentanyl patch. But, I mean, I couldn't tell you, I mean, probably have 0 patients right now on fentanyl patch. I mean, and most chronic pain management doctors had gotten away from fentanyl a long time ago, basically because it has a real erratic rate of absorption from a patch and can easily cause respiratory suppression and death, you know, when you're sleeping. So, I mean, the fact that their shipments of fentanyl went up like that in recent years at a time when most doctors are prescribing less of it tells you that most of that was going into criminal hands, probably.
Yeah, that's the only thing I can, that's the only thing I can fathom, is that, I mean, that's just tremendous growth. And I didn't know if, which one kind of preceded the other. If this kind of trend, I know this was just one of the top 10 distributors, but if this kind of trend prompted the government to kind of put the clamp down on prescribers, or
I think the overdosage rate is probably what caused them to, you know, it's kind of like anything else. I mean, it's, you know, if you're having a lot of shootings, you try to crack down on guns. I mean, is it going to stop the shootings? Probably not, because there's a lot of guns around. And, you know, and limiting what you and I can buy at Academy probably isn't going to stop the killings in Chicago.
Right.
And it's the same thing with narcotic overdose. If you look at the statistics, most of the overdose deaths are coming from a combination of fentanyl and heroin. And not truly from legitimately prescribed prescription drugs. But the only thing the government can control are the legitimately prescribed prescription drugs. If they could control heroin, they already would be. And they can't. And they can't control illicit fentanyl that's being manufactured in China or Mexico and shipped across the border, or illicit fentanyl that's being produced right here and shipped out by pharmaceutical companies to criminal hands. So, I mean, it's an attempt, but if you really break the statistics down, it's still mostly heroin killing people. There has been an increase in prescription drug deaths because there's more people using prescription narcotics, because there was a time period where they made it much easier to get them. When 20 years ago, a lot of family doctors I knew were kind of hesitant, kind of scared to prescribe narcotics because they didn't understand them. So it typically wound up being pain doctors that did more of the prescribing then. But then once it kind of got more commonplace, and especially with hydrocodone and at the time Darvocet, which has now been taken off the market, the family doctors got a little better educated and got more competent with prescribing those drugs. So more people were allowed access to them and more people got on them. Because, you know, it's like, oh, if I'm hurting and I can take a couple of pills a day and I feel a little bit better, then that's probably a good thing. Well, the problem, a couple of pills a day for the first 2 years ends up being three or four a day, five or six a day, as your body becomes more tolerant. And one of the other drugs that they're really severely curtailing its prescribing is Soma. And oh, wow. Soma is a very old muscle relaxant. The trade name is carisoprodol. That has been around for ages and is a halfway decent muscle relaxant, especially for somebody with back pain or that's had back surgery. Unfortunately, people cook that down with hydrocodone and inject it, and that's been responsible for some sedation and some overdoses in combination with narcotics. So now Soma is being cracked down on, and specifically what they call the street cocktail or the patients that would come in asking for a combination of Soma, Hydro, and Xanax. I mean, those are the three that typically would be cooked down and injected, and the pharmacy especially would, you know, would call you and warn you if you had a patient getting their Hydro from one doctor, their Soma from another doctor, and their Xanax from another doctor. Because they figured out a long time ago, you better not ask the same doctor for all three. So the people who were looking to abuse it would go to three different doctors. But now that all of that stuff is being tracked by the DEA, every patient that comes into a pain clinic or any other office for that matter, you know, you can run a DEA scan on. It's called a PMP, and it's the state of Texas, and it tells you, you know, everything that's restricted that you've ever been given a prescription for.
Oh, wow.
So, there's no way to doctor shop anymore. It's not like the old days where guy would come in and get Hydro from one doctor, get a little more from another doctor, get a little more from another doctor to sell it, because all of that's tracked now, and it doesn't matter even if you use different pharmacies or it all gets tracked by the DEA. And that report is ran on every single patient we see now, but that's the new guidelines. So that way you know if somebody left their previous pain management doctor because they were found to be on illicit drugs or were running out early or were constantly asking for early refills or losing their drugs. I mean, I've seen, you know, we have a joke that, you know, hydrocodone is the most hydrophilic medication on the planet, meaning that it's attracted to water, you know, because it falls in the sink, it falls in the toilet. I had one patient who their door slung open on a curve and it fell into a mud hole. I mean,
Why are you rolling around with your Hydros in a bottle in your car?
Exactly.
Not to take them while you drive. Why are you rolling around with them in your vehicle door?
I'm going to take it after I'm done.
Now, and occasionally you would get the legitimate stolen, where somebody's purse is stolen on the bus stop. Or nine times out of ten, it's family members that come over and steal your drugs. And that's one of the other guidelines, too, is that they recommend that patients have a lockbox, that they lock their drugs up. Because the minute you have a family get together and one of your aunts or uncles or cousins is over there and they're going through your medicine cabinet. If they find Soma or clonazepam or Xanax or hydrocodone or Percocet, you know, if they don't take the whole bottle, they're going to take five or six of them, you know? So, you know, one of the things that we educate patients with is to keep your meds locked up, keep them on your person. If you're going to travel, they have to be in the bottle with the prescription. Because it usually is a son, a daughter, or a family member. And that's also where the risk of accidental overdose comes. You know, for a while, I don't know if you remember, kids were having parties where they would raid the medicine cabinets of their parents.
Yep.
Everybody would bring pills, put them all in a bowl in the middle of the table, and eat them like M&Ms. So you don't know what combination you're getting. And if you get a kid that gets an extended-release, potent, long-acting narcotic, and they grind it up and snort it, which is what they do. It's called parachuting. Well, all of a sudden, you're not getting 60 milligrams of OxyContin that's meant to go into your system over 12 hours. You're getting 60 milligrams of OxyContin over the 1 second it takes you to snort it, and it is going to end up with you in the ER not breathing and probably dead.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of these opioid deaths are also people who are stealing the meds and using them inappropriately. So,
sure.
I mean, the guidelines were probably a good thing, and we're just trying to find good answers to actually deal with the chronic pain patients. And And one of the reasons I wanted to come on and do this show with you is just so the patients that are coming in can see that there's a frustration among the practitioners they're seeing too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, our main goal is to help people. And, you know, we were kind of trained to help one way 20 years ago. And now we're kind of being told, well, now, no, you got to erase all that. You got to do it this way. And it's going to mean, you know, 25% of the dose that you were on before. And there's just no really good answer.
Yeah, yeah, and that's just it. You know, I mean, of course, we talk about a cure to the opioid crisis in America. I mean, short of getting rid of opioids, you ain't going to have a cure. There is no cure-all. There is no one law we can pass that will rule them all. There is no one regulation that we can put forward. There is no one medication that we can have that will solve all these issues to stop cocktails from happening. It's such a complex issue, and it really does come down so much to regulating ourselves as people, regulating our actions, trying to make sure that, much like myself, if you don't have to go see a doctor to get that 0.5 milligram clonazepam, find another way if you can.
And that is one of the things we're working with people on, pain acceptance, and you know the fact that as you grow older and you get arthritis, you're going to get some painful, conditions, and they're going to hurt. You know, and we look for ways to minimize that. And that's what a lot of us explain to our chronic pain patients. You know, when they come in initially to see you, you know, say, well, you're going to get rid of this pain. And so probably not, you know, we're going to look to decrease it and make it a little more livable, but get you 100% pain free. Life doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I've got a question, doctor. 50 or 60 years ago, we didn't have a thing called an opioid crisis or any of this other stuff. I mean, did we? I don't think so. Did we have the same kind of pains back then? I mean, if we've got, it seems to me that we've
we
got,
did. You just lived with them.
Well, that's what I'm getting at.
Took your rheumatiz medicine called moonshine, right. And you just dealt with it.
Just a lot of.
Why do you think everybody
booze.
Was so crotchety and drunk?
I mean, this whole manufactured drug crisis, I know, is something that's come up just in the last handful of decades.
Yeah.
I don't know if...
Well, and you're right. We still had painful conditions back then, and people still hurt, but we didn't have the opioids that we have now. Now, once those were invented and people could find a way out of them, you know, and, you know, you could take a pill and your pain would be better, you're right. That probably started us down a downhill spiral. And then we have a generation now that's kind of not used to hurting. I mean, that's even what I noticed that with younger folks when we do procedures or we do surgery. I mean, they really expect they're going to, you know, that there should be a way that we can give them an injection and it not hurt, you know, or do surgery on them and then not have pain afterwards. Well, you know, I got a newsflash for you. Putting a needle in you is going to hurt. It doesn't matter how we do it.
You open.
It's going to hurt.
Right.
And it's going to hurt. You know, it's going to hurt when you have surgery. Now, is it going to be unbearable and kill you? Well, most people know. You know, now there are, you know, people, you know, perceive pain differently. And I see that. I mean, I get people where even the simplest injection, you know, they feel like they need to have IV sedation. And realistically, a lot of those folks, by the time I would start an IV, give them a sedative drug, I could have done the shot that they were there to get.
Yeah, I had to stick you with a needle to put that IV in you, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and a lot of it is, I think we've kind of groomed people to believe that we can actually stop, you know, near 100% of the pain somehow. Yeah. And that's just not possible. And that's probably where better education from us as pain management physicians needs to come into play. Instead of saying, we can fix you, you know, we can't fix you. We can try to make this a little more bearable.
We had those medicines at one point, and then the FDA came around and got rid of snake oil. There is no cure-all. Like I said, there is no cure-all. There isn't some dude in a magic wagon that's going to come by and sell it to you in a bottle. It's not going to happen.
Well, Huey Lewis had discovered it, I think.
Yeah, he did. He did. And he went deaf now. Be careful with that new drug. I'm sorry, Huey. I couldn't resist that. He just lobbed it over the plate. I love you. But it is one of those concerning facts, you know. We all have family members that deal with this, whether it be chronic pain issues or I would almost challenge anybody in America to look beyond their 10 fingers, 8 fingers, 2 thumbs, and tell me you don't know somebody that has been affected by opioid addiction. You know, that maybe you had the friend in the family that was like Rush Limbaugh, that had back surgery one day and 3 years down the line was popping oxys like M&Ms. You know, it's so easy. I actually got into the debate with somebody today. There was a debate ongoing and I just kind of rang in. But somebody was talking about whether or not addiction is actually a disease. And I was like, nah, yeah, it is. It's something that once you get it, it's never going to go away. It will always be there. You will all you can do from that point on is mitigate a flare-up. That's all you can do. Jerry Garcia said it. I'm an addict now. I'll always be an addict. The only difference is whether or not I choose to use tomorrow. The only difference. And he died from a heroin overdose, folks. He chose to use again. That was his choice. He knew it. He knew that it might be a possible outcome. That's the mentality that we have to fight against. That's what we have to fight. It's an internal struggle. Addiction is a real thing. The difference is it's kind of like diabetes and the fact that some diabetes you can prevent, some you can't. But if you have it, you more than likely had a genetic predisposition to it. You more than likely have a genetic predisposition to addiction in your family if you are an addict. So you have to be careful. You have to be careful. If you're one of those people that changes on a dime when you drink a beer, maybe don't drink beer. It's a hard reality, but like the good doctor said, we're never going to be 100%. We're a biologic machine. There are going to be things that are broken about us. The real question is, what can we do as people to try to make ourselves whole, so that there isn't that bottomless pit to try to fill with something else?
Well, and that's why I'm glad we're doing the show today. And that's
same here.
One of the main things for your listeners, that if you're in chronic pain and let's say you've been kicked out of your current pain management clinic, or you're looking for your family doctor has referred you to a pain management clinic. I just wanted to be clear for the listeners and for patients that are listening of what the CDC guidelines are. And the new guidelines are that you start with the least addictive medications you can for pain and work your way up. For family practitioners, it's 40 morphine equivalents, which you look on the link, figure out how to calculate that, because that's what your pain management doctor is going to be looking at, is how many MMEs, whether you're on 1, 2, or 3 narcotics, it can be a combination, but what is its equivalency in milligrams of morphine? And that's, you can calculate that with the same calculator that physicians use. Now, if you have chronic pain, if you've had multiple back surgeries and you're in chronic pain, your cutoff, according to the CDC, is 90 morphine equivalents, which is a fair amount of narcotic, you know, to help you get by through the day. Mm-hmm. But if your pain management doctor is telling you the cutoff is 40, then they're holding you to family practice guidelines, and you probably should be looking for a different pain management clinic. You know, especially if you're an existing pain management, chronic pain management patient who is already on, you know, 70, 80, or 90 morphine equivalents of something, then you're going to need to find that true pain management organization that recognizes what the CDC guidelines are and is not afraid to actually have a legitimate chart on you have all the MRIs, the scans, the nerve testing, you know, the POC, the urine testing, in order to have you on the dosage that you need to be on. So not saying that being over 40 is a bad thing. It's an arbitrary number. They picked it based on suicide, you know, on the overdose rates, you know, based on that, that your chance of sudden death and overdose certainly does go up as your morphine equivalency goes up. And they found that over 40, there's a slight bump, and then over 90, there's a pretty acute, steep bump in overdose death. So, but people that have been on these meds and been dosed up, you know, gradually, that need to be on a higher dose, then need to be in an appropriate pain management clinic where they do recognize the CDC guidelines. Because what has scared me is I've seen a lot of the clinics in San Antonio that alleged to be pain clinics start holding the patients accountable to family practice guidelines, which if you have somebody like someone like my previous lady I told you about with 17 back surgeries, she's not going to get by on 4 hydrocodone a day.
Mm-mm.
You know, she's going to need probably a combination of a long-acting and a short-acting drug. And then that's where you get into that 90 morphine equivalent range.
Well, I found it interesting when you were talking earlier, especially about that 90 morphine equivalent range in reference to hydrocodone, that it wasn't even the codeine that was the lethal part. It was the Tylenol.
It was the Tylenol.
It was the Tylenol that was lethal at that dosage. It wasn't even the codeine.
So, and that's what I need to be
clear.
Patients that are listening out there, I need to be clear on that too. Just 90 morphine equivalents is 9 hydrocodone a day, but there's not a practitioner on the planet that's going to put you on 9 a day.
Yeah.
Because 9 a day is going to be about 4,000 milligrams of Tylenol a day, which will kill your liver.
Good.
So,
God.
You know, now the other thing with, you know, that's a lot of people say, well, what if we just dose, you know, 5 or 10 ibuprofen 800s a day for pain? Well, you can't do that either because that'll kill your kidneys.
Yeah.
And ibuprofen abuse is a leading cause of renal disease in this country. So, so that's why when you get to, you know, dosages up around 90 morphine equivalents, you just about have to go to a long-acting potent narcotic combined with a short-acting breakthrough drug and still try to keep it under 90. You know, and that's where you'll see drugs like extended-release morphine,
yeah,
MS-Contin, you know, methadone, you know, drugs like that. And OxyContin, most of us have gotten away from prescribing because of its abuse on the street. For patients that are listening, Soma is going to be increasingly more and more difficult to get. I wish they would just take it off the market and be done with it. Because it, you know, you'll, as a physician, you'll be questioned more by a pharmacy when you write a patient for Soma than just about anything else.
And I remember years ago being in physical therapy for my back. That is what they gave me was Soma. So it was a regular prescription at one point.
And then like the experience you had with clonazepam, if you're in pain management and you need to be on a benzodiazepine along with your narcotic, don't expect your pain management doctor to write that combination because that's pretty much a licensed loser now. The only way that you're going to be able to get those meds is through a psychiatric referral like they did with you for your clonazepam.
Yeah. And once again, not to say that regulations aren't a good thing, that these things aren't necessary in some steps, but it definitely, I think I see the rabbit hole Randy was wanting to go down a while ago, or at least knocking on the door of, that we, of course, talk about all the time, good doctor, which is the concept of follow the money. I talk about it all the time that when HMOs came into the market years and years ago, that it really got rid of a lot of the old school style of doctor that you saw where it was like, well, you can't afford to pay this. We can work on a sliding scale. We can work on a barter system, what have you, in order to get your medical needs taken care of. To take that a step further, right up around the time that these issues started rising that we're talking about now was right up around the time that universal health care was pushed through and all of that. So it's a very delicate balance when it comes to the healthcare system that we have and the way that referrals work Even just the other day, I went to go get an appointment for my doctor to go get my prescription refilled. And they were like, "Oh, well, do you have us written down as your primary care physician on your insurance? We have to have that documentation before you can make an appointment." I was like, "Before I can even make an appointment?"
Yeah, that's a gatekeeper system, and you do have to appoint your PCP as your gatekeeper.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you have government funded insurance like Medicaid, mm-hmm. which covers very, very few procedures, but they'll cover your pain meds all day long because that's a cheaper way to cover you. Mm-hmm. So if you come in to my office and you've got Medicaid and you've got a herniated disc, well, they'll cover hydrocodone all day long. You know, they'll make
they
us pre-authorize and use a good, yeah, or your MRI, or, you know, it takes a lot of jumping through hoops to get your MRI, get you diagnosed, and get you into some form of treatment, be that shots or surgery, but they'll cover your hydrocodone all day. So, and I actually speak at the formulary board for Medicaid here, and I've told them that point blank that, you know, unfortunately, you know, some of these social services are probably one of the larger conduits of narcotics to the street. Because if you can go in and get your 6 hydrocodone a day for free, well, then you've got 2 or 3 a day to use and 2 or 3 a day to sell. So, mm-hmm. I mean, those guidelines, they are making it a little harder to pick up large prescriptions of it. And some of the insurance companies took these CDC guidelines early on 2 years ago and really ran with them to the extreme because it gave them an opportunity to search you on your meds. And we saw that a lot with our chronic pain patients who maybe were used to getting, you know, 90 a month of hydrocodone, 3 a day. Mm-hmm. And then they go to the pharmacy and they're, well, under the new guidelines, you know, we can only give you 1 week supply. You'll have to come in every week to get them. But
that's what
they
mine
charge
turned
you
into
full copay each time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what mine turned into for the last couple of months was, you know, like, and granted, I travel a lot, folks. This isn't the fact that I just haven't gone to the doctor. I spend a lot of time on the road. Can't say I've ever lost my prescription on the road, Doc, just so you're aware. never happened to me, oddly enough. Came home with my pills every time. Really weird thing. But it precluded me from being able to go to the doctor on my regularly scheduled basis to keep things going. So they literally cut mine down to 10 days. 10 days at a time is all that they would give me for my prescription. So these regulations that you're talking about are out there. They're in full swing practice. I've been witness to them and been on the receiving end of them.
And I suppose we needed them, but it's something that those of us as physicians, as well as our patients, are going to have to kind of figure out how to get by with together. I mean, because if we lose our licenses, obviously we can't prescribe you your meds. We're at a point now where the government is kind of dictating your health care to you. And I hear, would hear that every day, my patients, well, you're the doctor. Call my insurance company and tell them that this is the dose I need to be on. And I said, you know what? I wish it worked that way. And it probably did, you know, 50 years ago before I was a physician, but it certainly doesn't work that way now because all they'll do me is kick me off your plan and then you won't be able to see me at all. So, you know, it's, you know, we're just going to have to kind of get through this hard streak, figure out, you know, how we can prescribe safely. And then patients are going to have to come to the realization that it's not like the old days where, you know, because I see that all the time where we would put people on 2 or 3 a day and they'd go, well, you know, it really wasn't working. So I went ahead and doubled it, you know, and ran out 15 days instead of 30 days. Well, you know, you can't do that anymore.
Glad to see you went to medical school for 8 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, and, you know, and we would see that, you know, quite a bit or people would go through them all early and then claim that they were stolen. And, you know, and that just, you know, even if your meds are stolen in the old days, if you had a police report, we could replace them. Not now. The insurance company monitors your due dates. And if, you know, if you're trying to fill before your due date, it doesn't matter what happened to those meds, you're not getting them before your due date.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's just some things we're going to have to kind of get through. I think it's probably somehow or another going to be all for the better, because I think, you know, we have an entire generation of people that kind of got, you know, unfamiliar with actually constructively dealing with minor pain.
Yeah.
On their own, and it got easier to take a pill to handle it, kind of like Mother's Little Helper back in the 60s when Valium first came out. You know, I mean, the psychiatrist pretty much had every housewife on Valium. And I guess, you know, as physicians, everybody that complained about pain got put on a pain medication.
Yeah.
But for patients that end up in pain management, just remember, start with the least addictive. If you got to go up, then go up. Be expecting your doctor to monitor you. Use adjuvant medications, meaning, you know, use a little less narcotic and a little bit of an antidepressant, a little bit of an anti-inflammatory. That's, even though it's polypharmacy, meaning we've got you on three or four different drugs, that is the safer way to control pain rather than to expect gobs of narcotic to do it. And remember that if you're a chronic pain patient, 90 morphine equivalents is actually your cutoff. So, I mean, if somebody's trying to hold you to 40, find a pain clinic that is willing to monitor you and take the time to chart on you correctly to have you at 90 or below.
Or even, I would say, on the opposite side, Doc, if you go to a pain clinic and they are wanting to put you on something that high that you don't necessarily need, and not doing the proper paperwork, not doing the MRIs, consider that a red flag, folks. If you go in somewhere and they aren't doing their due diligence, you know, if they aren't looking at the insides of your body before they give you gobs of opiate, think about that. Like, good and hard, think about that. There's a reason they're doing that. And it's not a healthy reason. It's not a good reason. It's not necessarily something that's good for you in the long run. They really do have to get a good look inside of you and a good understanding of your case before they can just dole out medication. Once again, Doctor, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing this world of information, world of knowledge that you have with our audience, and for really giving us a physician's point of view as to what's going on. We hear so much from the news. We hear so much, especially from patients on these subjects, but we don't get to hear too often from the physicians themselves and what they're going through and what they're having to deal with. So thank you so much for coming on, breaking that down.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. And just remember, if it's frustrating for you, it's frustrating for your doctor too.
That's right.
So, I mean, he's not just trying to be a big meanie.
Yeah.
he's trying to protect his license. So, and hopefully this will pass and there'll be some kind of happy medium, or, you know, maybe somebody will invent a time machine, and once you get old and you're hurting bad, we can just send you back 30 years and I'll go with you.
Right. Well, on that note, Doc, where can people go to find out more about this information? We'll, of course, put that MME calculator into the episode post so that people can check that out themselves. But are there any resources that they can go to for this kind of information? Where can they go to find out more other than, of course, their physician?
Yeah, the CDC guidelines is... If you're looking at, if you're already in chronic pain management or being told you need to be in chronic pain management, definitely familiarize yourself with the MME calculator and go to the cdc.gov, and you will see the new current guidelines that are going to be what kind of guide you and your physician as far as your treatment. So better walking in the door armed with that knowledge ahead of time.
Fantastic. Thank you so much again for the wealth of information, Doc. You're always great to have on. The audience loves hearing from you. So anytime, any topic, as always, feel free to give a shout, and we'll have you on. While you're online checking that stuff out and checking out the great books that you can purchase by Dr. John Hall, Satellite Breed, A New a new breed, satellite terrorism, as well as guinea pigs, technologies of control. Those are both available on the Dudes and Beer store. Dudesandbeer.com/store is where you can get them. I'm about three quarters through my second read of Guinea Pigs, at least my own personal copy. I know whenever I was on air, I perused a copy years ago, but to own one now and be able to slowly digest that is just one of the most amazing things in the world. So thank you for all that information. While you're online checking that out, do make sure to go by, check out the HC Universal Network. That is the home of all of the great shows. Dudes and Beer, Yes But Why, Talking Sound, John Bound Politics, the all-new Richard Spazoff Show, who actually last Sunday, two nights ago, just interviewed Lamont from Sanford and Son. Go check that out, folks. Watch out. I'm coming, Ethel, or Edith. Sorry.
Thanks for listening to this episode.
Until next time, everybody. If you can't be good, be good at it. Take care of yourselves and each other. We'll talk to you soon.
Or chat with us live. Download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.